This is VOA News, Vuz via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Rescuers on the Gulf Coast, the U.S. used boats and high water rescue vehicles Thursday to reach people cut off by floodwaters in the aftermath of Hurricane Sally. Even as a second round of flooding took shape along rivers and creeks swollen by the storm's heavy rains. Across southern Alabama and the Florida Panhandle, homeowners and businesses began cleaning up, and officials inspected bridges and highways for safety. This is a day after Sally rolled through with 105 mile per hour winds, a surge of seawater, and 1 to 2.5 feet of rain in many places before it began to break up. China flexing its military muscle in response to a 3-day visit by U.S. Undersecretary of State Keith Krach to Taiwan. China, which claims Taiwan as its own territory, issued stern warnings to abandon the meeting. Friday, China said it is conducting military exercises near the Taiwan Strait, and what it says is it's its response to the situation there and to safeguard its sovereignty and territorial integrity. A defense ministry spokesman told reporters during a briefing that current efforts between the ruling Democratic Progressive Party of Taiwan and the United States to cause trouble will lead to a dead end. Joe Biden says that Russia will pay a price for interfering in U.S. elections if he wins the White House. The former vice president said Thursday during a CNN town hall near his hometown of Scranton, Pennsylvania, that Russia would face repercussions for attempting to influence November's vote. He declined refuse to say exactly what he meant, saying that it wouldn't be prudent to be more specific. U.S. intelligence officials believe that Russia is using a variety of measures to denigrate Biden ahead of the November election, and that individuals linked to Kremlin are boosting President Trump's re-election bid. This is VOA News. In a memo to U.S. attorneys Thursday obtained by the Associated Press, the United States Justice Department emphasized that federal prosecutors should aggressively go after demonstrators who cause violence, and even sedition charges could potentially apply. The sedition statute doesn't require proof of a plot to overthrow the government. It instead could be used when a defendant tries to oppose the government's authority by force. Attorney General William Barr has been pushing his U.S. attorneys to bring federal charges in protest-related violence whenever they can, keeping a grip on cases, even if a defendant could be tried instead in state court. Former FBI Director James Comey is set to testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee on September 30th, appearing just a month before the presidential election, as Republicans have tried to make the case that he and his agency conspired against U.S. President Donald Trump in 2016. Comey, whom Trump fired in May of 2017, will be featured to witness in a Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Lindsey Graham's investigation into the origins of the Justice Department's Russia probe. The president has long tried to discredit the investigation, which concluded with a 2018 report by special counsel Robert Mueller. The president has called it a hoax. Graham said that he has also invited Mueller to testify, but Mueller has declined. More than 944,000 people have now died from COVID-19 worldwide, and we've reached and surpassed the milestone of 30 million infections globally. Just three countries, the United States, India, and Brazil, together make up more than a third of the deaths and half of the infections. Just 2 weeks after students started returning to Ball State University last month, the surrounding county has now become Indiana's coronavirus epicenter. Out of nearly 600 students tested for the virus, more than half of them have tested positive. Dozens of infections have been blamed on off-campus parties, prompting university officials to admonish students. University President Jeffrey Mearns wrote that the cases apparently were tied not to classrooms or dormitories, but to poor personal choices some students are making primarily off campus. He said there are similar examples at other college towns across the nation. Bolivia's conservative interim president, Jeanine Añez, pulled out of next month's general election Thursday, a move that should strengthen other candidates running against the front-running Socialist Party of ex-leader Evo Morales. Añez said in a video message she sought to unify those opposing the candidates for the party of Morales, who resigned last year after an election sparked widespread protest. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Morning Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, September 18. And here are some of the stories we are covering. A Rwandan judge denies bail to Paul Rusesabagina.
We do not have much to comment about the court judgment, since that is not our mandate. But what we have to do is, as long as we are not being satisfied with the decision of the court, we still have rights to make an appeal, which we have already made.
A Cameroon judge upholds life sentences for 10 separatist leaders. Kenyan senators pass a long-awaited county's revenue sharing bill. Libya's UN-backed prime minister offers to resign in the name of national unity. And the search continues in Uganda for 200 inmates who escaped from a maximum security prison.
It happened when the prisoners who were carrying food were coming in, and then they were raided the gatekeeper. Then, of course, a group from inside joined in, overpowered the gatekeeper, broke the armory, removed the guns, and started scattering.
And a fear of violence ahead of today's gubernatorial election in Nigeria's Edo State. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's post are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Rwandan judge on Thursday denied bail to Paul Rusesabagina, the man portrayed in the Hollywood movie Hotel Rwanda, for his role during Rwanda's 1994 genocide. His lawyers asked for the bail on grounds that Rusesabagina was not well and needed to seek medical treatment. But a judge ordered him jailed for 30 days because she said there was enough evidence that Rusesabagina committed the crimes he is alleged to have committed. Rusesabagina is charged with 13 counts, including terrorism, complicity in murder, and forming or joining an irregular armed group. Prosecutors say he may face 25 years in jail if convicted. David Urugaza, one of Rusesabagina's lawyers, says he has appealed the judge's ruling.
The request was not granted, and immediately, of course, since we are not being satisfied with the decision, we have made an appeal.
So the judge said that, looking at the charges, that there was reason not to grant the bail. But why? I mean, is the judge concerned that Mr. Rusesabagina might flee?
We do not have much to comment about the court judgment, since that is not our mandate. But what we have to do is, just as long as you are not being satisfied with the decision of the court, we still have rights to make an appeal, which we have already made.
Which court are you going to appeal to?
The appeal has to be made at the superior court than the one took the decision, so which means that we have made an appeal at the intermediate court.
When we spoke yesterday, I mentioned whether you are concerned of a fair trial. Are you concerned that he may not get a fair trial?
You know, when two people are in a dispute, of course, they might have some who lose and some who win. So if the decision was not on our favor, then it cannot be a time to say that this was not a fair trial or what. But what I can say is that's why the judge has made the two levels, that whoever who is not satisfied can make an appeal. So it can be earlier to say that the trial was not fair, no. But we were not satisfied with the decision.
Yes, you were not satisfied. I'm sure he too and his family probably are disappointed.
You are the one who said that because I haven't talked to them. I'm not aware about that.
So
I was not satisfied.
Yeah, so, I mean, he's your client. How do you think he felt?
Yeah, I was with him. We were together, and all of us have decided to make an appeal all together.
And when do you hope to file your appeal?
I have already made it. Immediately after getting the decision, I went to the office and I made an appeal.
When is the next hearing?
We are waiting for the court schedule. The only what we are in, it's just to make an appeal, but the rest is for the court to make their schedule of the hearing.
Thank you for bringing us up to date.
Thank you very much.
David Rugaza is one of the lawyers for Paul Rusesabagina of Rwanda. He was speaking with us from the capital, Kigali. An appeals court judge in Cameroon on Thursday upheld life sentences for 10 jailed Cameroon separatist leaders. The judge rendered his decision without giving defense lawyers an opportunity to plead their case. A military tribunal in Yaoundé sentenced separatist leader Sisiko Ayuktabe and 9 others to life after they were convicted of terrorism and rebellion against Cameroon. The separatists are fighting for independence of Cameroon's 2 English-speaking regions. They were arrested in 2018 in Nigeria and deported back to Cameroon. Amangwa Tanyi is a spokesperson for the jailed separatist leader's legal team. He says the ruling is a travesty of justice and that the separatist leaders plan to appeal to the Cameroon Supreme Court.
I'll just brief you by saying that it's a scandal of its kind since I started practicing like a lawyer. I mean, the judge lacked everything, even his integrity. He put it aside today. He decided to sacrifice his integrity.
What reasons did the judge give for upholding the sentence?
There is no reason, because our clients are appellant and they did appeal for this matter because there was travesty of justice at the trial military tribunal Yaoundé. And our clients have never been given their day in court. The lawyers themselves have never been given their day in court. The reason is that he called our clients, opened the session entirely in French, and he did not speak in English. And he expected our clients to be robust to understand him. And he decided to give the room to the prosecution or the legal department to come up and say, come up with observation that what they want the judge to do is that they should rely on what happened at the military tribunal to dismiss our appeal and then to maintain or uphold the life jail sentence that was slammed on them. That is just all. I've never seen this type of practice. I've never seen it. We are witnessing an anathema to justice.
Was Mr. Tabe and the other defendants, were they present in court? And what can you tell us about their physical being?
They were present in court, but I will tell you their physical being and their mood was not the best, because since this matter entered the appeal court, they have denied them access to their lawyers. We've never met them. We seldom just meet them in court accidentally. We don't know whether they're coming or not. We don't know whether they serve them with their production warrants. We just meet in court accidentally. And the submissions that we wrote and we filed to the respondent, we've never got any reply. And just for the judge to decide to do what he did today, shamelessly. In fact, it is one of the most scandalous judgments that we've ever had in history, as you see in our documents. I mean, our clients can never get justice out here. Everything is a sham. It's a sham. In common law jurisdiction, this cannot happen. It cannot happen.
So what's next? What's the next move for you, the lawyers?
We are common law lawyers and we believe in justice, despite the fact that they're using unorthodox means in order to discourage us. We are professionals and we think that the world will hear us one day, and they're setting a bad precedent as far as the civil jurisdiction is concerned. You know, we are common law and we are used to the inquisitorial system of justice and not the inquisitorial as the Francophones. So we know one day we're going to get there. We're preparing the matters during the Supreme Court. We are upbeat and we're sure we're going to continue to teach them law.
Thank you very much again for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you, sir.
Amangwa Tanyi is spokesperson for the legal team of 10 jailed Cameroon separatist leaders. You're speaking with us from Buea, the capital of the Southwest region. Uganda's prison authorities and security agencies are searching for over 200 inmates who escaped from a maximum security prison in the northeast Karamoja region. Authorities on Thursday said they captured 9 and killed 3 of the prisoners who were partly motivated to escape by fear of contracting COVID-19 in the cramped prison. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
Police, army, and prison personnel are combing Uganda's Mountain Moroto area, searching for the inmates who have been on the loose since Wednesday. The inmates were among 219 prisoners who fled the Moroto prison in Uganda's semi-arid region of Karamoja. Frank Waine, the Uganda prison spokesperson, explains to VOA how the mass escape was carried out.
It happened when the prisoners who were carrying food were coming in. And then they were raid the gatekeeper. Then, of course, the group from inside joined in, overpowered the gatekeeper, broke the armory, removed the guns, broke the main gate, and started scattering. So we already have about 9, and the search is still continuing.
This is Uganda's third largest prison escape since 2006, when 500 inmates fled a facility in the West Nile region of Arua district. Another 300 escaped a prison in Adjumani district in northern Uganda. Uganda's prisons house more than 61,000 inmates, and many of its facilities are overcrowded. The prisoners have not been spared from the coronavirus that officials say has infected 5,380 Ugandans and caused 60 deaths nationwide. Raine says some prisoners in the Moroto facility were diagnosed with the infection and that four staffers were under quarantine. Many more inmates have tested positive throughout the country.
The number is about 511 and about 14 staff. But the good thing is that our people are all asymptomatic. Actually, about 153 have already recovered.
Raine says officials have increased vigilance around prisons to ensure there are no more mass breakouts as they focus on capturing the escapees from the Moroto facility. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, September 18. Kenya's 47 counties government workers can now resume work after they were directed to take 14 days mandatory leave due to lack of funds to pay their salaries. Now, and as Atieno Odhiambo reports from Nairobi, the Senate on Thursday passed the controversial revenue allocation bill to make possible allocation of funds to the counties.
So, honorable senators, the results are as follows. Abstentions, zero. Yeah. Nays, zero. Yeah. Ayes, 41. The ayes have it.
Senate House Speaker Kenneth Lusaka announced after the voting process. Kenya has finally seen light at the end of the tunnel after senators unanimously passed the third bill for revenue sharing among the 47 counties. Counties will get an equitable share of $3.7 billion. The formula, described as a win-win, ensures that no county will get less revenue than they did in the previous financial year's budget. Speaking from the Senate House, Bungoma County Senator Moses Wetangula said that the passing bill yesterday Thursday put rest to a protracted debate in the country.
This formula, Mr. Speaker, brings to rest a long, winding, noisy debate in the House. Noisy and messy debate in the country, Mr. Speaker, that has now come to an abrupt end. This House has risen to the billing as the defender of counties. And in so doing, Mr. Speaker, we are giving the country a formula that will work.
No county shall receive in any financial year an amount of shareable revenue that is less than the amount of shareable revenue received by the county in the financial year 2019-2020.
This move will now enable counties to resume full operations a day after the Council of Governors chairman directed all governors to shut down essential services due to cash crisis in the counties. During a news conference, Chairman Wycliffe Oparanya announced a partial lockdown of the counties, sending most county workers on compulsory leave due to lack of funds. Chairman Oparanya said this was necessary because the Senate failed to pass the county revenue allocation bill for three long months.
First and foremost, we would like to set the record straight that the shutdown is not a decision by the chairman of the county. This has been occasioned by the delay to pass the County Allocation Revenue Act 2020, hence a delay in disbursement of the equitable share of revenue.
The Senate had failed for a record 10 times to agree on the best formula for disbursing funds to the counties. The bill now awaits President Uhuru Kenyatta's signature, which will give the Treasury the green light to disburse funds and end the cash crisis in the counties. Atieno Odhiambo, VOA Daybreak Africa, in Nairobi, Kenya.
As Libyan political leaders discuss uniting Libya's two rival governments in talks in Geneva, the prime minister of the country's UN-backed government in Tripoli says that he is ready to step down in the next couple of months to pave the way for a new national unity government. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
As rival Libyan political leaders prepare for a new round of talks in Geneva next month, UN-backed Tripoli Prime Minister Fayez al-Sarraj says that he is ready to step down to ensure a peaceful transition of power. He says that he affirms his sincere desire to hand over his duties to a new executive authority by the end of October, assuming that Libya's dialogue committee has completed its task and chosen a new ruling council and a new prime minister. Libyan negotiators agreed to a number of principles during last week's talks in Morocco, including elections in December 2021 and dividing positions in the ruling council from among Libya's three geographic regions. Colonel Ahmed Al-Masmari, spokesman for Eastern Military Commander General Khalifa Haftar, insisted at a press briefing that Haftar and those who back him seek a political solution free of outside interference. He says that General Haftar and his forces are following a path to solve the Libya conflict without outside forces imposing their will on Libya. He says the Libyan conflict would have been resolved long ago were it not for outside meddling. Faisal Bourika, representative of the Libyan parliament at the recent Morocco dialogue talks, claimed in an interview with Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV that al-Sarraj was under militia pressure to step down and left Tripoli after taping his announcement. VOA could not independently confirm the claim. Khatar Abu Diab, who teaches political science at the University of Paris, says the Libyan prime minister announced his resignation because he was disavowed by forces in Tripoli following a recent tug of war with his interior minister, Fathi Bashagha. He adds that there are now three negotiating tracks, including U.S. and U.N. efforts to make a deal, a Russian-Turkish agreement for a possible agreement, and European efforts to arrange a deal. He says that it is time to bring all three tracks together. Paul Sullivan, a professor at the U.S.-based National Defense University, says the upcoming Libya negotiations are likely to be fraught with tensions and behind-the-scenes maneuvering. The talks, he says, may last longer than some think and may not solve much, barring a miracle. Sullivan also says he doubts that Libya will quiet down anytime soon. There is too much at stake, he says, and too many competing stakeholders who do not get along. Egyptian political sociologist Saeed Sadiq says conventional wisdom was that the Libya file situation would be postponed until after U.S. elections, but now it seems things can't wait. The Europeans, he adds, may be preparing an international conference to redraw the map of Libya. Eastern-based interim Libyan Prime Minister Abdullah Al-Thani also announced his resignation over the weekend, but it has yet to be accepted by Parliament. Libya has been effectively split between rival Eastern and Western governments since 2015. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The Nigerian Bar Association says it is monitoring election-related activities leading up to today, Friday's gubernatorial election in Edo State. The group says it has deployed its members across the state as election observers. The election, which is expected to be competitive, pits incumbent Governor Edwin Obaseki from the main opposition People's Democratic Party, the PDP, against Pastor Osagie Eze Ayemo from the governing All Progressive Congress Party, the APC. Voters in the state have expressed concern about possible violence. John Apopo Martins, first vice president of the Nigerian Bar Association, tells viewers Peter Clotty that the concerns of election-related violence are legitimate.
For now, everything seems to be quiet. The town seems to be safe. There's no tension. There's nothing that we have to be afraid of.
There certainly have been concerns that there could be possible election-related violence, perhaps during the election process. Do you think the concerns are legitimate?
The concerns are legitimate because to the extent that if you listen to both sides, the tension is high, a different scenario that we are going to be faced with from experience. Because by the time the security is very high, then the boys mobilize, the thugs mobilize, and find it very difficult to come out during the election. Again, from experience, during the coalition, that is when this is very, very difficult to curtail the thuggery if they really mean to come out to disrupt the coalition. Because during coalition, most of them are not. They are held in the night, in secluded places, primary schools or secondary schools, and there is usually not enough security to handle it. I really don't know why. But let's see what happens. I doubt whether that's what's going to take place, but let's see what happens tomorrow. But I'm very sure that the voting process itself, casting of votes and counting of those votes at the polling booths, will highly be successful.
Incumbent Governor Godwin Obaseki recently embraced his main rival and contender. Do you think this sends a message? In spite of the contention ahead of the election, there should be peace?
In Nigeria, our politicians are very, very fast in mouthing peace, respect for peace and for law and order. But in truth, they don't obey it, and their followers don't obey it. From my perspective, peace will not hold just because Yaman Obaseki hugged each other somewhere or signed some document somewhere. No. Peace can only hold because the security forces are on ground. If the security forces are not on ground, they're going to have a lot of problems. So I've been speaking to one or two persons, and the feedback I'm having is that the boys themselves are getting wiser. That you go to the field and are shot dead, you just die for nothing. So most of them are not really willing to go all the hog. Once there is security men visibly on ground, I'm very sure that we won't have a violent election.
Okay, what are your expectations about the credibility of the election?
The truth of the matter is that in Nigeria, as it is, as I swear, the election are not rigged on the day of election in the real sense of the word. Now, the question you ask yourself is, the ADNET, ADLOC staff, the electoral officers, who are the polling officers, how were they recruited? Nobody knows. Usually, that is where the rigging starts from. So, apparently, I have never really had the belief that our electoral process is 100% foolproof. But you see, the society we live in, and we just learn to live with it. But as for the actual voting, I'm foreseeing a situation where people will come out tomorrow to vote, because I think for the first time in a long while, the two major parties, that is APC and PDP, are feeding candidates from the same environment, that is from the Benin sub-tribe of Edo State.
John Aikpopo Martins is the first vice president of the Nigerian Bar Association. He was speaking to viewers Peter Clotin. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the latest football rankings released by world governing body FIFA. It is the first FIFA rankings in 6 months. Senegal is the top-ranked African side at number 20. The Teranga Lions are followed in second place by the Carthage Eagles of Tunisia, while the Super Eagles of Nigeria occupies the third position in Africa, but 29 in the world. Belgium, France, Brazil and England remain the top four, with Portugal moving up two spots to replace Uruguay in the top five. Staying with football news, African countries are gearing up for a return to international football next month, but with many borders throughout the continent still closed due to the COVID-19 pandemic, most teams are headed to Europe to play. Cameroon are traveling to the Netherlands, Guinea to Portugal, while the likes of Cote d'Ivoire, Nigeria and Tunisia will head to Austria, where it is easier for them to assemble squads because they are mostly made up of European-based players. The next FIFA window for international football from October the 5th to the 13th is the first opportunity for African national teams to play since last November. The pandemic saw international football cancelled for all except European countries this month. An uncertainty over travel around Africa led the Confederation of African Football to put back the resumption of official competition to November. In South Africa, Gavin Hunt has been appointed as the new head coach of Kaizer Chiefs, the club announced on Thursday. The Cape Town-born mentor will start his job immediately, and his contract will see him take charge of the Amakosi's first team for the next 3 seasons. Gavin Hunt will meet the team for the first time next week when the squad return to training in preparation of the 2020-2021 season. And on to West Africa, where Nigeria's Minister of Youth and Sports Development, Sunday Dare, says contact sports will soon resume in the country under strict protocols as recommended by the Presidential Task Force on COVID-19 in the country. The minister disclosed this on Thursday in Abuja after the unveiling of the National Artificial Intelligence and Robotics Hub. He said the ministry was working closely with the Presidential Task Force on COVID-19 in Nigeria to ensure contact sports resumes in the country under strict COVID-19 protocols. In athletics, the former head of athletics governing body, Lamine Diack, has been sentenced to 2 years in prison after being found guilty on charges of corruption related to the Russian doping scandal. A Paris courthouse announced on Wednesday that the 87-year-old was found guilty of soliciting $4.1 million from athletes suspected of doping to cover up the allegations and allow them to continue competing, including in the 2012 London Olympics.
He was handed a 4-year sentence on Wednesday, two of which are suspended, and fined $594,000. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a very good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, September 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson Omale, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.